Chris Boyd. Up next on Think, do you judge people based on how they speak? And why is that any more socially acceptable than judgments based on skin color? We'll spend this hour with psychology professor Katherine Kinsler, talking about the ways our vocabulary, our accent, even our sentence structure serve as markers of identity. We'll consider the extent to which we all size people up according to how they sound and learn how language use relates to power. Our conversation starts after a short break. A young attorney arguing a case for her client.
402G's conclusive presumption, automatically and irrebuttably ranking husband principal breadwinner, displays the pattern Justice Brennan identified in Brunteiro. In practical effect, laws of this quality help to keep women not on a pedestal, but in a cage.
And here is the same woman, after years on the U.S. Supreme Court, having arrived as the woman fans fondly refer to as RBG.
I certainly was given a tremendous boost into the public arena by the notorious RBG. When I was asked about it, I said, well, it's exactly right, because notorious B.I.G. and I had something in common. You did? What? We were both born and bred in Brooklyn, New York.
From KERA in Dallas, this is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. Did you hear the difference there? In the first clip, she's really careful about making sure we hear those R sounds at the end of words. Later, with decades more experience as a person whose power and influence are assumed, Ruth Bader Ginsburg speaks more like herself, a kid who happened to grow up lower middle class in Brooklyn. The shift back to her natural pattern of speaking reflects Ginsburg's self-confidence, just as the practiced, more artificial early speech reflects her understanding of one of the most common, least acknowledged forms of prejudice in America. We tend to judge people based on how they speak. My guest thinks it's time we talk about that and about how wrong we can be when we let ourselves make assumptions based on other people's accents, word choice, or turn of phrase. Katherine Kinsler is professor of psychology at the University of Chicago. Her book is called How You Say It, Why You Talk the Way You Do, and What It Says About You. Katherine, welcome to Think.
Thank you so much for having me.
All right, Katherine, let's get this out of the way. Most of us don't think of ourselves as speaking with any discernible accent, but we all do. How does it happen that people in different parts of the country speak the same language with different dialects?
That's exactly right, that it's really common to hear things like, well, I don't have an accent, but somebody else does. And of course, that's impossible if you pause to think about it, that your accent is the sound of your language and everybody speaks with a characteristic sound. Now, our language is also not all the same. And that's because languages can be somewhat of a moving target, both over time and across individuals and even with one person across their lifespan. And the way we speak reflects our social identities and our connections and our social aspirations. And often it also reflects something about our childhood.
So to go back to Justice Ginsburg, why would gaining social and career status over time give her the freedom to speak in the way that is most natural to her, but not necessarily associated with great wealth and prestige?
I find this to be such a fascinating example because you see two things. So, you know, you see the younger lawyer who really, as you said, has something to prove. And, you know, there's a lot of research showing that people can feel insecure about the way they speak because, of course, society can judge you based on your speech. And so sometimes you see people hyper-correcting, trying to be careful to speak in what they think, you know, society perceives as the most privileged way of speaking. Now, you also see in the later years that she's showing off the voice of her youth. And there's something really inspiring about that in the idea that when you've really made it, you feel confident in yourself and you feel confident in your voice.
You know that U.S.-born children tend to develop accents that resemble those of their peers rather than their parents, if their parents hail from some other part of the country or some other part of the world. What is that about, and what does it tell us about the social function of sounding like the people around you?
Kids, like everybody, really want to fit in. And I think this example really shows how social language is. And so you want to sound like other people who are around you. And so if you're a child, sounding like the other kids at school can feel like such an incredible social marker of who you are and who you're affiliating with. And so in this sense, I think you're really seeing the social side of language coming through.
So does this affect how children choose playmates?
It can. Now children choose playmates based on many different factors in their classrooms. But one kind of research that I've done is look at kids' responses, more of a stripped down laboratory-based approach. And so here you can say, you know, control for kids' familiarity with different people or any sort of particular aspects of their local social environment and say, okay, you're just meeting two new kids. Here's what they sound like. And then often what we find is that children will express preferences for people who speak in their own language or in a familiar accent of their language, or in this case of these children of immigrants, we've studied children of immigrants who really say that they prefer people who speak in English with the local dialect that their peers speak in.
How early do babies start to show a preference for people who speak like the people they know best?
This starts to emerge really early in life. Now, there are some studies going back several decades that look at even newborn babies' early preferences for speech. And these are babies who are just born. And some studies show that due to what they've heard at the very end of pregnancy, now it probably sounds a lot like hearing speech that's muffled underwater. Mm-hmm. So it's not to say that they're getting a lot of input, but even right away, they like the sound of a language that sounds familiar to what they've been hearing and listening to their mom speak. Now, as babies get older, some of my studies show that within the first year of life, they start to orient to and prefer people who spoke to them in a familiar accent of their native language. Now, I don't think that this is necessarily bias or prejudice in the way that adults have. At the same time, it shows how right away we're orienting to language as providing this really incredible social signal.
So could there be some evolutionary explanation for babies preferring those who come from their own linguistic group even before they can speak themselves?
I think that this relates to a general preference for people who are familiar. And in many senses, familiarity denotes some sort of safety and, you know, somebody who's like your caregivers. And this can be okay in infancy. But of course, if as adults, we continue on just preferring people who are familiar, you can see how really broad societal problems can develop from this early instinct.
You share a fascinating anecdote in the book under the heading, Julie Isn't Racist. Can you talk about the experiment that you detail there?
Sure. So in this study, we were interested in children's early social preferences for new people. So like the studies that I mentioned before, you have a child come into the lab and you show them new people who might look in different ways or sound in different ways, and you ask them who they like or who they want to be friends with. Now, in this particular example, I talked about a study where we were looking at white monolingual English-speaking kids in the U.S., and they were 5 years of age. And when we show them pictures of people who vary in race, so for example, white and black faces, we find that the kids often express a preference for novel white faces. Now, this is sad and speaks to a long history of race-based preferences and segregation and racism in this country, but I think that these kids are really just starting to learn about race and structures of societal racism. So when they express a preference, say, for the white kids, parents get really uncomfortable, which I think is a good thing because they're really thinking about trying to correct racial disparities. Now, when kids, in contrast, show a preference for somebody who speaks in a native accent of English, what we find is that parents are just seem much more relaxed. It's as if preferences based on language just don't seem as problematic to them, that they think something like, oh, and you know, we'll sometimes hear parents respond something along the lines of, oh, well, my child's just really good at languages. Now, we find sometimes that if you pit language against race, so for instance, if a child is deciding between somebody who looks like them and speaks in a foreign accent versus looks different from them and speaks in a native accent. In some situations, we find kids think that accent matters a lot more than race. So again, I think there's something optimistic in this, in the idea that that kids' early race-based attitudes are still developing, and we might be able to intervene as parents and educators in a society. At the same time, I also think that we're very unaware of the importance of linguistic attitudes and linguistic prejudices, and this is something that often flies beneath the radar.
Yeah, you were left with this question of why we think it's more acceptable to discriminate based on how somebody speaks, because this can be toxic in a lot of ways and have lasting implications on people's lives.
I think it can be a really pernicious form of bias, in part because we don't realize that we're doing it. And so, for instance, people may think something like, well, I'm not being biased against this person, or I'm not being racist, or I'm not being prejudiced in any way. It's just, I don't think this person's a very good communicator. I'm having trouble understanding them. But it turns out that so much of our comprehension and our ability to speak with somebody and understand them, all of that can be informed by our social biases. So if you don't like the way somebody sounds as a listener, often times you might shut down and really not try to understand them.
Yeah, you've done some interesting experiments, or you write about interesting experiments in which people are asked how they're asked to transcribe something that someone has said to them who is speaking with a foreign accent in English. And there are certain people who say, I cannot understand this, but it turns out the truth is a little more complicated than that.
That's right. And you start to see this dissociation between subjective feelings of understanding and more objective measures. And so researchers can find these situations where somebody says, oh, I really can't understand that person. You know, what a heavy accent. But then you might have somebody else listen to the same speech and they might say, oh, you know, I hear a bit of an accent, but it's not that strong, right? So first of all, the notion of how strong or heavy an accent is seems to be very subjective to begin with. And then you can even see some complexity in people's ability to understand. And so for instance, somebody might say, oh, that person wasn't a very good communicator. I didn't understand them very well. And then when they're asked more direct comprehension questions about what they actually heard, they seem to have understood them just fine. And so there really can be this disconnect, and people's feelings about what they understood don't always map onto reality.
And this can affect who, say, gets hired for a public-facing job.
It absolutely can. And when we think about employment protection laws, often you see that there's some ambiguity with the degree to which speech discrimination is protected. So, for instance, insofar as your accent is signaling your national origin, it's something that's considered a protected category from employment discrimination. But you get this complexity with the question about who's understandable and how good a communicator somebody is. So again, an employer could say, well, this person just isn't that good a communicator. And so because of that, I can't hire them for my job. Whereas you can see that social biases and prejudices about speech can really infuse the judgment about whether or not someone's a good communicator in the first place.
So speech could be used almost like cover to not hire someone for a particular reason from a particular background.
It can be used as cover. And in many senses, I think people, again, aren't aware that they're being prejudiced. And so this is, you know, I think that a lot of times this is something where people can actually perhaps, you know, genuinely believe that somebody is not a good communicator. And it's because as a society, we really haven't done the work to think about the role of speech in our lives and to make ourselves aware of how we can really be prone to prejudice when we're listening to people who speak in a non-standard or a foreign accent.
My guest is Catherine Kinsler, professor of psychology at the University of Chicago and author of How You Say It, Why You Talk the Way You Do, and What It Says About You.
a lot more grown up than the first album. It's a lot more well-rounded style-wise. I have two ballads on it, and I've never recorded a ballad before.
This is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. That is Madonna speaking in 1984 in an interview. My guest this hour is Catherine Kinsler, professor of psychology at the University of Chicago and author of How You Say It, Why You Talk the Way You Do, and What It Says About You. Let's listen now to another interview of Madonna in the early 2000s.
Religion is synonymous with not asking questions. And what I call religious thinking is robotic thinking. It's, oh, you know, we do things because this is what our ancestors did, this is what my father did, my grandfather. And as I was raised a Catholic, and I had questions like, you know, why did God create the world? And why is there so much sadness? And why is there war? And why do good things happen to bad people and bad things happen to good people?
All right. It sounds, Catherine Kinsler, like Madonna has taken on a new accent long after most people do so. She was in adulthood. But research you found shows some people are especially likely to end up matching the sound of the people around them.
So language is really fascinating in that in some ways it's really fixed, that when you speak, you're often showcasing the voices of the people who spoke to you when you were a child, given that, as we all know, it's so difficult to learn a non-native language or a non-native accent into adulthood. Now, at the same time, you do find changes across the lifespan for some people, and often that can represent a new social environment or social identity or social aspirations. And so you do see some shifts for some people that when they're coming in contact with a new group of people or they're really identifying in a new way, their voice can reflect that.
So obviously, being bilingual means that people think and speak in two different languages. How do some bilingual people change their affect depending on the language they're speaking in?
Yeah, there's these fascinating studies showing that when a bilingual person speaks in one language or another, they really bring up these cultural feelings and experiences in one language or another, one linguistic context or another. And you can see, you know, the same person saying to you, wow, I really feel like two different people in my two different languages. And that you can even see this in things like, what do they remember? That their feelings of themselves and the particular memories that come up can really be somewhat different across their two different languages.
You write about a woman who talks about when she's speaking Japanese, her body moves in a different way, and she's not doing this on purpose.
That's right. She's not. And so it's something that she's, you know, she talks about how she takes on the posture, the way of speaking, the amount of eye contact that she's typically done in one context or another, and that comes out when she speaks.
Why is it so much harder to pick up a second language without any discernible accent after a particular age?
It's a really wonderful question. And in some ways, we don't exactly know the answer of why it is that we've got this critical or sensitive period in language learning. Now, what we see across a lot of different data is that children, and young children in particular, are just incredibly well equipped to master languages. And so, you know, you can have a little kid who's exposed to multiple languages and just picks them up with ease. And then you can look at a college student who might be really purposefully trying to master a non-native language, either in a class or studying abroad. And of course, people can learn languages into adulthood. They can, and I would say even they should. I think it can bring a lot of advantages. But often it is just incredibly difficult to master a non-native accent, that they're forever going to stand out as somebody who learned the language as an adult as opposed to as a child.
So my children's first language is English, but they have a cousin whose first language is Spanish. And when they were very small and they would hang out with this cousin, he would swear in English, and it didn't seem to be very upsetting to him. He didn't seem like he was transgressing. They were really horrified by this. Why is it that swear words in our first language have more emotional impact over us than a language that we pick up later on?
That's a great anecdote. And in fact, there's even studies of people, things like how aroused they get. So, you know, how just, you know, slightly physically aroused you might feel when you hear a curse word. And indeed, people do find it very, you know, upsetting or jarring, right? And the idea is that when you hear words like that in your first language, it feels slightly more emotional. And some researchers argue that the language you first spoke or the languages you first spoke as a child have this emotional feeling and this real emotional resonance to them, whereas languages you maybe learned later on feel a little bit more psychologically or emotionally distant, such that it's easier, say, to say a bad word and not feel those same arousing psychological consequences.
Languages also change as people move to different parts of the world and settle there. How do dialects form when speakers of a common language go to different places? For example, there were English people in the United States at its formation, but we don't speak English like the British anymore.
We don't. And languages evolve. They're constantly changing. And so, I like to think of an example. Imagine humans way back when, say, as hunter-gatherers, and you could imagine moving on two different sides of a mountain range, and then all of a sudden, you're going to start to speak in different ways. And you can kind of extrapolate from that example to modern days and say, any kind of social change or a juncture in terms of how people interact, that's going to create language change. And so when new groups come together, their language starts to come together. And when groups come, start to break apart, their languages change too. And so changing languages reflect our social divisions.
Do adult speakers always think the people who sound like they do sound the best, the smartest, the most competent?
Often, I can't speak, of course, for all people in all times, but often you see that. And one place in particular you see that is when adults judge adolescents. Now, for your question about language change, often it's the adolescents and even potentially the adolescent girls who were really the drivers of language change. And insofar as you think of adolescence as a time when children are growing up and creating their own identity and perhaps rebelling against the older generation, that's again a place where you're going to see language change. And so, it's really common to hear adults say, oh, kids these days, they just don't do this right. And they don't speak this way in the right way. But of course, when those adults were children, somebody presumably didn't like the way that they spoke too.
All right, I want to go to the phone. First up is Charlene in Denver. Hi, Charlene.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I just called to say I so appreciate the last comment about how we change our language when we move. I grew up in Texas, West Texas, went to school in Texas, and then moved immediately to New York City and totally had to change the very strong accent that I came from Texas with. And I had a speech teacher in college who told us how to change our accents. One was to change the way we say the words get, as in get on up here,
uh-huh.
And to say get, and how we say the word gist, as in wait just a minute. And you can see that when you change those words, everything changes. And I've never gone back, but when I do go to Texas, I certainly pick up more of that accent. But back then, it was not as fashionable to have a strong Southern or Texas accent.
Thanks so much for calling, Charlene. Do you want to respond to anything there, Catherine?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's a great example both about how, when people move and you've got this new social community, your voice might change to reflect it. But also I hear a lot of, this idea of having somebody help you change. I think what you hear there is something that linguists often talk about as linguistic insecurity, this idea that the way that I'm speaking isn't valued by society or isn't the way that somebody should speak. And I hope that people listening really pause and reflect on the idea that all ways of speaking can be really valuable ways of speaking and that there isn't necessarily a right or wrong accent or dialect to have.
We all have so much exposure to gifted actors on TV and in the movies who can change their accents that it seems like it must be pretty easy. Why is it actually so hard for most of us?
Yeah, I mean, I love seeing these examples of actors when you think you know somebody and you know your favorite TV show, and then all of a sudden you realize, actually, you know, that person is British and feigns an American accent completely convincingly. And it's just, it's really jarring as a listener, I think, because you've categorized them in this way that it kind of changes your feeling of, you know, whether or not you know them. And so I think the fact that actors do this so convincingly, it really shows how gifted they are, because, you know, regular speakers can't just all of a sudden start to say, as an American, start to speak in a British accent in a way that a British person would find compelling.
You say categorizing people. This was really interesting to me. So we might have a brief interaction with someone and not recall what their hairstyle was like, what they were wearing. We always tend to remember, in general terms, their race and their gender presentation. Do we remember details about how they speak, whether or not we perceive them to have an accent?
We do. And so, you know, kind of the classic example you might hear in an introductory social psychology class would be something like, I was really busy, I wasn't paying attention, I ran into this new neighbor, and then afterwards you feel awful because you might not be able to pick her out of a lineup, but you say to yourself, well, she's a middle-aged white woman. So you remembered something about her, right? But it's her category membership, nothing about her necessarily as an individual. And so if she spoke in a different language or in a dialect of English that wasn't your own, absolutely, in that case, just as easily, you'd remember something about her speech as well.
Okay, let's go back to the phone. Derek is calling in from San Antonio. Hi, Derek.
Hi, how are you today?
Very well.
Gotta say that I have lived this entire program today firsthand through my wife, as well as myself. My wife speaks four languages. She's from Africa, and she's lived in Britain, Canada, as well as Ghana. So through the years, I have been amazed, even as late as 20 years into our relationship, that when we were at a wedding, and she's asked to stand up and speak, she goes into the language, style, the communication, emphasis on certain words and the hand gestures. And I'm looking at this woman that I've been married to, and I'm like, who is this?
Wow.
Because of the ingrained communication style that she learned as a kid. And even to this day, she has the ability to speak with a British accent. But what we both share in common is the fact that our parents, being from two socially, economically different strata, her parents, educated professionals, mine, working class individuals, stress the importance of proper diction and how that is going to affect our ability to move up in terms of social economic status. And even to this day, my kids, who have lived nothing but an upper income lifestyle their whole life, the emphasis that we place on them is the importance of sentence structure, proper tense when they're speaking, and how important that is in creating a perception of who you are and how that's going to affect their ability later in life to provide a quality life for their kids.
Well, Derek, thank you so much for calling. What remarkable anecdotes you've given us. I'm really glad you called. You put a lot on the table there. We're going to get a response from Catherine in just a moment. This is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. All right, Catherine, Derek did have a lot of really great stories drawn from his own life. Talk a little bit about what he had to say.
Yeah, so, you know, I really loved that story of his wife speaking different languages from really different cultural backgrounds. And then when she stands up and gives a toast at a wedding or speaks with different communities, he sees these facets of her that he doesn't see typically. And, you know, I think it really shows how people can have these incredible diversity of linguistic experiences, and that can really shape their, you know, their feelings about themselves and their ability to communicate with others. You know, I'd like to just, it really makes me think of some research research that I've done and that other researchers have done, looking at the impact of being exposed to different languages and different cultures early on. And I think it can be a really positive thing that in some of my work, we find that kids who are exposed to linguistic diversity, even if they're not really fully bilingual themselves, even if they're just exposed to people who speak in different ways, they start to get better at perspective taking. So taking the linguistic perspective of others, thinking who knows what, who understands what content, who communicates with whom. And I think that's such an important hallmark of effective communication and interpersonal understanding more generally, to be able to take someone else's perspective.
Derek talked about his parents, his wife's parents, and now he and his wife as parents, really stressing the importance of speaking good English. Who decided that in some cases what is thought of as white English is the standard English?
Right. And that's, of course, not fair. And so, you know, one thing that I think is a really important message is that sometimes when people think about different dialects of English, they think something like, again, back to the idea of, oh, well, maybe I don't have an accent, but everybody else does, which is wrong. They might also think something like, well, my dialect of English is correct. And a different dialect of English is just like mine, just not as good. So, you know, having this sort of misconception that other dialects and other ways of speaking are like mine, but just more error prone, something like this. But in fact, that's not how language works. And so different dialects grow up around their speakers, and they have internally consistent grammars, and they have characteristic ways of sounding. And so in that sense, there isn't necessarily a right or a wrong way of speaking in terms of how different dialects work and how language changes and forms. But as a society, we often apply the social and even sometimes moral judgment to speech in terms of thinking about a right and a wrong way to speak. And again, I hope that's something that people can reflect on.
My guest is Catherine Kinsler, professor of psychology at the University of Chicago and author of a new book called How You Say It: Why You Talk the Way You Do and What It Says About You. This is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is Catherine Kinsler, professor of psychology at the University of Chicago. Her book is called How You Say It: Why You Talk the Way You Do and What It Says About You. Here is NPR White House correspondent Aisha Roscoe.
No one has told me to change my voice at NPR. Nobody that, you know, works at NPR has said, oh, you need to do this or that. They've been really supportive, and I think that it's important for people to be able to hear a voice that sounds like theirs speaking with authority, and that you don't have to sound a certain way to be intelligent. You don't have to sound a certain way to be professional. You know, you can be professional and sound the way people talk.
So, Catherine, Aisha Roscoe is just an amazing reporter, which is why she is where she is. But hearing her on NPR tells me we have a long way to go in my profession, because a lot of Americans sound like Aisha Roscoe. Not a lot of them appear on NPR or a lot of other broadcast outlets.
I mean, I just loved that that clip you played. I think it's so inspiring and so important. And just that idea about, you know, when we think about diversity and inclusion and who has a voice and, you know, who's really who's driving the stories, that absolutely we should hear a diversity of voices of people who speak in the way that people speak. And that's a really inspirational way to frame it.
How did you get interested in this field of study?
Well, I'm trained as a developmental and social psychologist, and I'm really interested in questions about how we start to think about social groups and social identity and where prejudice comes from. In terms of thinking about language, I spent this summer right before I went to graduate school. This was in 2003, and I spent the summer traveling in the Balkans, in Croatia and Serbia and Bosnia. And I had this language textbook that I carried with me, and it was called Introduction to Serbo-Croatian. And when I got there, I discovered that that's not what people called the language, that they would say Croatian or Serbian or Bosnian, and even, you know, say things like, well, don't say it that way. That's a Serbian way of speaking, say, if you were in Croatia. And so, you know, this is a really naive observation that anybody, you know, any linguist or anthropologist could tell you, which is that, again, language change reflects social change. And this was, you know, the former Yugoslavia. It was after a civil war. And when nations change, their languages follow suit. And I came back to the U.S. and started thinking about what do babies and young children think about linguistic diversity. Really early in life, do we start to think that when people speak in different ways, that means something important about them, that people who speak the same might be more alike or like the child, or people who speak in different ways might be different? And do we start to have these early social intuitions about language, and what do they mean?
Let's go next on the phone to Heidi in Baton Rouge. Hi, Heidi.
Hello. How are you?
Very well, thanks.
Okay, I've just got a couple of comments to make. First of all, the more I've listened, the more I've been impressed by this study. I'm truly impressed by it. I think it's awesome. I think its time is way overdue. But I would like to say a couple of things. Mainly, number one, you know, diversity is fine, but there's a huge difference between dialect, accent, and actual good grammar. Okay? You know, so I'm a huge grammar freak. You know, if your grammar is proper, you can speak with any dialect or accent you want.
What do you think about that, Catherine?
Well, just to interject that often different dialects, they're going to have different characteristic accents, but they also might actually have different grammatical structures. And so I do think it's an important thing to realize that people may not always be aware that something that might sound like a grammatical inaccuracy to your ear because of the particular dialect that you speak, that if you step into a different dialect, it's not necessarily your dialect spoken grammatically inaccurately. It could actually be completely grammatically accurate for the dialect that's doing the speaking. And so in many senses, you know, the correct way of speaking, now what we learn in school, of course, is one thing, but the way that people speak doesn't necessarily need to follow some sort of grammar in the sense that how you might think about grammar from schools in the sense of something that you're taught by educators, but actually our minds learn grammars as children and speak in the ways that that the languages around us speak.
The point that I heard someone make once is that if you can understand what someone is trying to say, then they've made themselves understood. Just like a rule in a grammar book doesn't mm-hmm. necessarily mean that that you can't understand what someone's trying to get across.
Yeah. Also, back to, you know, I think that the caller really is also kind of brings up for me the ideas about how sometimes adolescents will shift the language, right? And there can actually be new grammatical forms that can form in a language that a generation ago, your ear might say, absolutely, that's not okay. And then an adolescent will say, yeah, we can say it that way, no problem. And so these things are constantly changing. Now, of course, I also think that language learning is really positive. And so if you have a child at home, say, who's learning a language other than English, it's really important for the school to provide support in terms of learning English in schools. At the same time, I also think it's really important for schools to provide support for children who just hear English and learning other languages too.
All right, let's go next on the phone to Deanna calling from Dallas. Hi, Deanna.
Hi. Oh my God. I'm a teacher. I teach Spanish in Dallas, and I'm a fellow linguist. I, you know, PhD in literature and linguistics, and this is an amazing, amazing call. Thank you so much for having this conversation. My brain is in Spanish. That's what I tell everyone. I grew up and was born and raised in Puerto Rico, yet I learned English since the beginning. I don't remember my life without English. Every year it was English class. Everything else was in Spanish. And what you just said about supporting, like schools giving support,
I have three children who are also bilingual. We only speak Spanish at home. They go to school in English, and now my first grader is in a dual language program, and it's all beautiful. However, my initial question 20 minutes ago was, I have found myself, and we've talked about prejudice in the show, you've talked about it. I find myself tired at the end of the day and just like not caring to hide my accent, and I sound more and more like Latina or what somebody could think about what is a Latino accent. Yet what Aisha, the NPR correspondent, was saying, you know, I'm Dr. Torres, I'm Dr. Torres Rivera, and there's so many markers that put me in certain boxes depending on where I am, that I sometimes, and I think I'm doing it right now, I try to change my accent to sound more American or non-English speaker. And is that something that with age will go away, or as I am more established in my profession and I'm more respected by my actions and my, just life, will I just not care enough? It's just so tiring to be fixing my accent. And on top of it, I speak Italian as well. And on a note, as a teacher of Spanish, we've chosen to throw out textbooks I'm the department head of my school, and we use comprehensible input. And what you were saying, I think, Chris, was as long as there's communication, your needs are met.
Well, thank you so much for calling, Deanna. What do you think about all that, Catherine?
Yeah, that's just fascinating. And I love your stories. And, you know, it sounds like you have so many amazing identities and aspects of your life that you can embrace, and speaking differently in those different places and social spaces, I think, is a really wonderful thing. I guess my broader hope is that this country is ready for a linguistics revolution. And what I mean by that is the idea of really rethinking the value of linguistic diversity, the value of being able to speak and know and hear different languages. And I think a lot of that starts in schools. And so I think it's amazing that, you know, you're teaching languages in schools and your kids are learning multiple languages in schools. And the more that we do that, the more that we see language learning is a really fundamental aspect of education. I hope that people's attitudes and biases and prejudices are going to shift as well.
This is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. You did find research that suggests Latinos who speak with a discernible accent may be more susceptible to prejudice than those who don't have an accent.
That's right. And so you can see, you know, you can look at studies really in different arenas. So you can look at studies of housing markets. And so who's more likely to get a mortgage when you look across or have a landlord call them back when you look across a whole bunch of people applying who might otherwise be statistically indistinguishable. And you can see that people who speak in what's considered to be a stronger non-native accent in English are going to be less likely to succeed. You see this in people's earning potential, so how much money they make. And you see this just in day-to-day interactions. And so when people are made to feel that they're not as good communicators, even if they in fact are, it can just take a really taxing, it can feel really taxing on people and really take a psychological toll.
All right, back to the phones now. We have Stephen calling from Austin, Texas. Hi, Stephen.
Hello. I'm a gay man, and if I'm in a room of people that I've never met before, I can hear another person speak across the room and recognize them as another gay man. I recognize that accent. And if 90% of us are being raised by heterosexual parents, where are we learning this accent, and why is it always the same?
Thanks for calling.
It's such a great question, and I do talk about this. I think it's really fascinating in my book. So, you know, one question is, how reliable is that, right? So how easy is it to pick out somebody who, say, a gay man in a crowd? And it does seem that, you know, Stephen's right, that there is, there's some truth to it. But, you know, a couple of things are worth noting. One is that this characteristic notion, often the stereotype of something like a lispy speech, something like that, that turns out to not be true. That if anything, if there are discernible features to gay speech in the U.S., it's often this more hyper-articulation, a cleaner, crisper vowel. And then the second thing to note is that it's not everybody. So people are above chance at guessing, as in like above 50-50, but they're not very high at guessing. And so there's a lot of overlap in different people's speech. And I think the idea here is just like any change in social communities, that if you have a community and you have an identity and you affiliate with these people, that your speech is going to start to match theirs. And so it really shows the social influence on how we speak.
There may be people listening who are thinking for the first time about their own linguistic biases, because it's not something we really talk about. Do you have a suggestion for how all of us can sort of check our thought patterns and our behaviors in case we might have been discriminating without really giving a whole lot of thought based on how other people speak?
I think that just pausing to reflect on it and having conversations like this one are so important, that I hope that listeners will now notice language in their lives and pause and think, oh, wait, you know, why am I thinking this thing about this person? Could it be because of their speech as opposed to anything they actually said or did, or anything that's really about them as an individual? Now, the other thing I would caution is just the idea that we can all be better listeners, that often we think about communication as something like, well, this, you know, I said my thing and it's out there in the world and I did a great job and now I'm done. But actually, communication is two-sided. And so as a listener, if we don't like the way someone's speaking, we might shut down and not engage and not ask follow-up questions. So I think reminding ourselves to be more engaged listeners is something that's really important.
Finally, I know that you're a proponent of speaking multiple languages. You know, we're really lucky if we have parents that make this available to us. Is it ever too late to learn a second language?
So I think that's right, that we're really lucky if we can give this to our kids as a gift early in life. And it's really hard to in many family situations. Now, one thing is that kids go to school, hopefully, and schools can do a really amazing job of providing language education if they have the funding and the resources and the teachers to do so. But then I also think it's important to remember that it's not too late, that as an adult, you might not sound like a native speaker. That's, you know, pretty much a given, that if you start learning a language late in life, you're not going to sound like a native speaker. But you can absolutely learn a new language, master it, communicate with new people, expand your worldview. And I think that's a really important thing to remember.
Catherine Kinsler is professor of psychology at the University of Chicago and author of How You Say It, Why You Talk the Way You Do and What It Says About You. Catherine, thank you so much for spending this hour with us.
Thank you so much for speaking with me.
You can like our page on Facebook. We're on Twitter at KERA Think. You can subscribe to our podcast free wherever you get your podcast by searching for KERA Think, or you can listen on our website, think.kera.org. Again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening. Have a great day.